episode of the Platinum Sombrero Podcast is brought to you by Lance Bass Pro Shops. No matter what time of year it is, whether it's already August or it's going to be May, we've got exactly what you need to shed that squeaky clean boy band image. You too can become a rugged outdoorsman with no strings attached. It ain't no lie, both your wardrobe and your tackle box can be fly, fly, fly. So if somebody's tearing up your yurt, stop into a Lance Bass Pro Shop today. Come visit any of our five locations, with our newest store located between 98 degrees HVAC and Boyz II Men's Warehouse. Lance Bass Pro Shops. Get in sync with the outdoors. Patent pending.
+51,000 on their feet. Nobody's left to beat the traffic tonight, I guarantee you. Mark gets the sign. The wind and the pitch, here it is. Swung, fly ball, deep left center. Grissom on the run. Yes! Atlanta Braves have given you a championship.
25 lighters on my dresser. Yes, sir. You know I got to get paid. Five lighters on my dresser, yes sir. You know I got to get paid.
Swing and drive, back to right. Welcome to the show.
I got 25 lighters on my 25 folks.
Now get ready. This is the Platinum Sombrero Podcast with your hosts Dylan Short and Adam Doc Herbert.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Platinum Sombrero, brought to you by Armchair All-Americans in conjunction with MyBookie.ag. MyBookie.ag, the number one place on the interwebs to go for any and all online gambling needs. With college football season set to begin soon, MyBookie.ag needs to be on your favorites tab. If you like to lay a little money down, lay a little lines on the opening week of college football, use our promo code BRAVES25 and they're going to give you a 50% deposit match just for signing up and using our promo code. They have all the best lines completely updated. Their customer service is second to none. If you ever have a question that you just can't figure out a line, remember, there's no such thing as a dumb question. Their customer service is second to none, quick and easy to use. Their lines are easy to find. I mentioned before, if I'd been smart, I would have laid down the money on Ronald Acuna hitting 30-30 this year before the season even started. Unfortunately, I wasn't smart. Don't be like me. Go to mybookie.ag, use our promo code BRAVES25, and play today. And get ready to go and show off how smart you are. All right, so we're doing this on Thursday, so the game hasn't started yet. But this series with the Mets, Doc, you and I feel pretty vindicated, you especially. Everybody was kind of getting all high and mighty. All the national guys have been on the Mets jock pretty much during the entire run. Oh, the Mets are back. Yeah, they're back all right. They're back in third place.
I mean, and this isn't to discount the fact that they were winning, because, I mean, they absolutely were. You know, they just happened to be beating a whole lot of teams whose winning percentage hovered somewhere between 375 and 425, and now they're playing the second-best team in the National League, and they're getting dealt with. Our bullpen is certainly trying to gift them a win, but yeah, I mean, now the pecking order has been reestablished, and you're not really hearing a lot out of everybody saying Mickey Callaway is a candidate for manager of the year. Like, no, he's not. That's not a thing. That was never really a thing at all.
That might have been Bob Nightingale's dumbest thing that he's posted this year, and he posts a lot of dumb things. So glad he could say that a guy that was about to be fired a month ago was manager of the year because of a stretch run against some of the worst teams in baseball. But whatever.
You know, it was nothing on his take where he said that the Didi Gregorius trade was approaching Babe Ruth trade territory.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, that was 2018's greatest hit. So, you know, we'll see what happens tonight with this Braves Mets series. With it's Julio Teheran versus Marcus Stroman, and Stroman was kind of like he was the igniter ever since. They shocked everybody at the trade deadline, and instead of selling like everybody thought they were going to, they went out and they bought. They got Stroman, and that was kind of when they caught fire. So we'll see. Ground ball guy. He was one of the most coveted trade pieces at the deadline for a reason. So no matter what happens, though, the Braves have already won this series, and that is good news.
And Stroman's a guy that I think the Braves match up pretty well with in particular. I said this on the Locked On show for Thursday, for those of you that that don't listen to that show. You're hurting my feelings, but I understand it. Doc is kind of the key member of the squad here. But I did mention that Stroman is the type of guy that the Braves generally can do very well against, because the Braves aren't a team that you want to go into giving up a lot of contact. And Stroman's the guy that gives up a ton of contact. Now, most of it's ground ball contact, but there's only so many times you can give up hits to this Braves team before they make you pay.
No doubt. The offense continues to just be completely relentless. It was nice to see in last night's game, see the BABIP gods kind of smile on the Braves a little bit after after it seems like they had turned on us in the last little bit. So hopefully we can keep that going tonight as well. I mean, winning two out of three is great, but a sweep against a division rival, and you know how I feel about the Mets. Sweeping the Mets is just, it's just beautiful, and would complete this whole putting them back in their place thing.
And I think it would pretty much salt away the division, if we're being honest. I keep an eye on the Nationals because I do think that they're an incredibly talented club, but I still think the Nationals buried themselves to this Mets team on that type of run. Those runs get tricky. When you get momentum in your favor, you start beating teams you shouldn't. So if the Braves can go out there and complete the sweep tonight, then pretty much put a ribbon. With 6 weeks left, I think you can pretty much put a ribbon on the National League. And last night was really cool for me to see, because put up six without hitting a home run. I couldn't tell you the last time that happened.
I didn't notice that while it was happening, but you're right. That seventh inning was... It was crazy to see Callaway, former manager of the year, candidate Mickey Callaway, pulling Steven Matz after 79 pitches. And I get it, because he was putting Seth Lugo in, but they just relentless, you know, the walk and then single after single after single. And yeah, for a team that has relied on the home run ball as much as they have, it was really cool to see them manufacturing runs. And like I said, the BABIP gods kind of smiled on them for a second. They're going to kind of have to do that. They're not going to, when they get to the playoffs, they're going to be facing really, really good pitching all of the time. And they don't seem quite as adept this year at performing really well against the really elite pitchers that they will wind up seeing in the playoffs. So that's going to have to be a mentality shift that they adopt moving forward. And now is as good a time as any to kind of get used to playing like that, and not just saying, okay, Donaldson's going to hit us a three-run jack right here and give us the lead or bring us back to within one in this game or something like that.
And I honestly think you learn more about a team in games like last night's, where you're having to string together hit after hit after hit without relying on the home run, because the home run is such a prevalent factor in today's game. Everybody can hit home runs. I mean, if you were to look at the worst home run hitting team in baseball this year, I believe it's still Miami. And they've got probably about 100 or so home runs. If you were to look 10 years ago, I would bet you that they wouldn't be last. That's just such a prevalent thing with the home runs these days, that anybody can kind of go up there and hit a three-run jack, and all of a sudden you're up 3-0. Or anybody can hit 2-3 home runs in a game, if you're talking about a team, and put up a ton of runs that way. When you're having to manufacture hits like that, I think that kind of speaks more to the length of your lineup, more so than having a couple guys just bomb on you. Like, Ronald Acuna can hit 2-3-4 in a game, obviously, because it's Ronald Acuna, but you kind of, when you said that they haven't done that against elite pitchers, you hit the nail on the head. And last year was kind of an anomaly. You're not supposed to beat the best pitchers in the game like that. But when you get to the playoffs, these are the types of games that you can kind of fall back on and rely on. This kind of shows you that when they need to, the Braves can overcome a quote-unquote power slump, or when pitchers are actually putting the ball where they want to, and the Braves are still going to be able to manufacture some sort of offense.
And after a while, it starts kind of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy for a pitcher. Like, if somebody hangs a slider and it winds up getting hit over the wall, okay, that's fine, you can recover. But when you have what happened to Seth Lugo, and it's the walk, and then just every single ball is finding a hole, which we're seeing a lot with the Braves bullpen these days, it starts to kind of get in your head a little bit, and you're like, oh my God, what's going on? And then, you know, okay, don't hang one over the plate. And so what's the first thing you do? You hang one over the plate, and it winds up getting hit in the center for yet another hit. So it gets annoying. You know, teams like the Braves are really pesky. It's kind of like when we played the Pirates back a couple months ago, and just like, God, the approach, how is this team not better with this type of offensive approach? So, and I think that once again, like you were just saying, that comes back to the overall length of the lineup. So it's good to see. But speaking of home runs, and you know, let's not completely abandon the fact that we can hit home runs. But we are seeing something historic right now out of Ronald Acuña.
Absolutely, what Ronald Acuña has done at 21 years old, there's really not a superlative or an adjective that that actually can fit it correctly. It's just fully amazing what he's been able to do, and he's got such easy power. Like, I think that's the craziest part to me. Like, he hits more home runs to right center field than he hits poolside, which is not supposed to happen. And he's not even 200 pounds. He's about 6 foot, about 185 pounds. He's just got this crazy amount of explosion, and his hands are he's got this preternatural sense of staying on playing through the zone, and he hits the ball so hard that he doesn't have to have the big body to do it. When you're watching Ronald Acuña, a lot of people like to joke and say, you know, National League Mike Trout. He kind of is.
He really kind of is, and that's almost blasphemy. And for all of the different names that Trout passes every year on the WAR list, and saying like, God, he's even if he retired today, he'd be 51st in baseball history, you know, and he's not even 30 yet. And you see what Acuña's doing, and he's obviously got a long road to wind up sustaining that type of track record. But I mean, once again, I said this last week and the week before that, the fact that we can even have the conversation about him going 40-40 is nuts. And 21 years old, he's a child, basically. You know, he's, I mean, what more can you say about it? He's must-see TV. Every time that I see that the lineup is turning over, it's like, no matter what I'm doing, I just am locked into every single thing that he's doing. Nothing that he does surprises me anymore, and he's still so joyous and so happy. He is my favorite Brave of all time, and he has been on this team for, you know, 16 months or something. It's crazy. I just, what a gift. He almost signed with the Royals, he almost signed with the Diamondbacks, but he didn't. There's been a lot of things for this organization that have gone wrong in the last, you know, we'll say 5 years or something, the rebuild, the international sanctions, all of that. But I mean, we're lucky. We are witnessing something really, really special. Whether he gets to 40-40 or not, that just so special.
And when you're talking about 40-40, that is an elite club. You're talking about Jose Canseco, Alex Rodriguez, Barry Bonds, and Alfonso Soriano. And should Acuña do it? And by the way, if he can actually hit enough singles, he can do it pretty easily. He would be the youngest ever to do it. A-Rod did it at 22, I believe, in 1998. He debuted debuted at 18 in 93. So I think 22 was when he did it. If Acuña manages to go 40-40 this year, that is going to be one of the longest lasting achievements until, you know, maybe you get somebody crazy like Wander Franco, maybe. A 40-40 guy, that's a rarity. You don't see many guys with the power to hit 40 home runs, still have the speed to steal 40 bases. And there's another historic number he could be climbing the year after that. When you look at Alex Rodriguez and a number that ties him to Mike Trout, by the way. Right now, Mike Trout, I believe, is the youngest player in history to reach 100 career home runs and 100 stolen bases. And Trout did it at 23 years and 253 days. Acuña could beat that number.
It's just another testament to how well-rounded he is. I mean, and power-speed combo is so special. I mean, just because you're fast doesn't mean you know how to steal bases. And, you know, just because you've got raw power doesn't mean you can necessarily get to it in games. So, at the beginning of the season, when Brian Snitker, you know, he said, we're going to put Acuña at cleanup, and everybody's going, boo, we don't like that. You know, you can make the case from the traditional standpoint and say, okay, Acuña, he is your best power hitter. Even with Freddie Freeman, even with Josh Donaldson, Acuña is your best power hitter. But he's also your best leadoff option, too, from the traditional sense, because he's high OBP. He's stolen bases, he's first to third, he's all of that good stuff. So Snitker recently came out and referred to himself as a dumbass for having not put Acuña in the leadoff spot, which is about the most glorious self-effacing mea culpa I've ever heard in my entire life. So he really does fit anywhere. You could put him second. You could put him third. Fifth, you put him wherever. He's going to wind up being the best player there. I mean, 6 to 6.5 WAR a player at age 21 is. I can't use any word other than special. He's so special.
And if you listen to the rest of the Braves talk about him, and you can kind of see it around Major League Baseball now, a lot of Braves fans get upset that we don't get the national attention. Ronald Acuña most definitely is getting the national attention. He's getting a huge push behind Major League Baseball, and you can see why. He has such a joy of playing, and it's infectious, really. It's just you keep saying special, and I think that's the best word for it. You're talking about a guy that didn't start stealing bases until like the All-Star break, when all of a sudden he's just like, you know what? I think I'm going to steal bases now. And he's on the verge of going 30-30.
Yeah, it's like it's that Michael Jordan thing of like, I could do whatever I want if I wanted to. And must be nice to have the physical ability to just do whatever you want. So,
is he leading baseball, period, in steals?
I believe so, yeah.
And that's with like 2 months of not running at all. And just
yeah. And he's 28 out of 34 this season. So he's getting really good reads. Obviously, he's super fast, but knowing how to steal bases, this is one thing when people talk about Christian Pache coming up and being a five-tool guy, which he is. The difference is Pache's reads are bad. He can't steal, even for as fast as he is, he can't steal bases. And like I was just saying, just because you've got speed doesn't mean that it translates into being able to do this. So I'm going to use that word special yet again to describe Acuña. And now that he's in right and you're seeing the full scope of his defense, like Carlos Collazo was talking this week about the term five-tool being just completely thrown around and abused, but this is a case where it's really true. You see, I just did it to describe Christian Pache, so I'm not immune to it either.
Well, see, I like that Carlos said that, friend of the show, Carlos Collazo, because I agree it gets overused. In a traditional sense, when you're talking about Acuña as a center fielder, he's not five-tool. His defense is not stellar. If you look on his Savant page, he's not generally he doesn't get good jumps or good reads. But he's got a great arm, but he's not a traditional five-tool type of guy. I think that the five-tool thing kind of gets thrown in synonymously with amazing player, and it's kind of not the case. There aren't very many true five-tool guys in baseball, so I don't usually refer to Acuña as a five-tool. Now, if you're just talking about him in a corner, then I think he gets much closer to approaching that five-tool mentality. Although, for as fast as he is, it is kind of mind-boggling how many balls drop in front of him. And that may seem like I'm just nitpicking, but it just kind of goes to show you that as good as he is now at 21, he's still going to get substantially better.
That's the scary part. Right, you look at guys and say, you know, they usually hit their decline, say, early 30s, which is somebody who's in his late 30s is very offensive. But he's 21 years old. You know, he's going to finish this season as 21, and so by the time his contract starts to run out, because pointed this out last week, I mean, we're 4 months into that contract extension. Like, his decline isn't necessarily going to start coming on for a very long time. So the trajectory is pointing straight up for him.
And it's led a lot of people to talk about if he goes 40-40, which is a huge possibility, he needs, what, 12 steals and six homers to reach that plateau in 6 weeks, which he definitely can do home run-wise. Steals will be close, but he definitely has the ability to do that with his high OBP. Will he find himself in the MVP race, which to this point in the season has been pretty much a surefire bet of Yelich or Cody Bellinger?
I still don't think so. Yeah, even for as amazing as the season is, and 40-40 is no small feat. Like you said, it's an elite class. This would be the fifth time it's ever been done, ever. But even through all that, the only player who's ever done it before who wound up winning MVP was Jose Canseco, and that was the very first time. So it doesn't necessarily mean you're a shoe-in to do it. Now, last year, it was a little bit before this. It was before he went on that August run last year when he solidified that he was going to be Rookie of the Year. Because it was very neck and neck for him and Juan Soto for a lot of last year. But that was when he was like, yeah, I think I want to win Rookie of the Year. Just like he did about wanting to, he woke up one day and decided that he wanted to steal bases. So if he keeps this up, then maybe we can start talking about it. But, I mean, there are so many different categories. For me, it's Cody Bellinger. You look at every single thing that Bellinger is doing, and he's not five tool, but he's four elite tools, Bellinger is. And every statistical category is higher than Acuña. So except for runs, I think. I think that Acuña is leading in runs. But beyond that, Bellinger is beating him in, like, everything. And Christian Yelich, even he missed a little bit of time with a back injury, so he might be kind of dinged up a little bit. He might not be able to finish, but 40-40 is special. Yelich has a chance to go 50-30, which has never been done before.
No, and that's the thing to me. If Yelich really does go 50-30, he's winning the MVP hands down. And Bellinger's done some great things, and Bellinger doing it in L.A., I know a lot of people want to say that it doesn't matter where you're at. It absolutely does matter where you're at and what big a stage you are. If you're in L.A. or New York or Boston, then you've got an easier time of winning an award like that. But what Christian Yelich has done really the last two seasons, we talk about Acuña just saying, hey, I'm going to steal bases now. How about Yelich just like, you know what, I'm going to start hitting homers now.
You were talking about how slight Acuña is, how he doesn't have the home run hitter build. I mean, Christian Yelich looks like he weighs 160 pounds soaking wet. He's got the wrists, he's got everything. His timing is absolutely elite. So, you know, if Acuña keeps it up, I mean, if the tear that he's on continues, I mean, you're looking at possibly being able to get to 50 home runs. So that's not to say it's going to be easy. He's got 6 weeks to hit 16 home runs, which if there's anybody in the league that I trust to do it, it is Acuña. I mean, August is just a special time for him. So I don't know. If it was right now, I would go Bellinger, Yelich, and then Acuña. I mean, don't forget that Ketel Marte, who I was outraged, started at second base in the All-Star game over at Ozzy Albies. He's got a higher WAR than Acuña does right now. He's got 5.3 WAR, and Acuña's at 4.9. So we love him. We see him all the time. He's electric. The smile is infectious. Everything he does seems to be highlight-worthy. But that doesn't necessarily make him the best yet. He's going to win an MVP, at least one in his career. It just may or may not be this year.
And I still think that that's the craziest thing. We're talking about this at 21. There's a lot of fans who are going to feel like he's getting jobbed if he doesn't get the MVP at 21 years old. Like, you're seeing stuff from him. And by the way, Mike Trout, his first full rookie season, had a 10 WAR season. That's when he went 30 homers and 49 steals. There is some different levels to this. But what you're seeing from Ronald is just, it's the first time since Chipper Jones that the Braves have had a player that nationally, not just in Atlanta and the surrounding states, but nationally, people can look at and say, that's a top five player in baseball.
And I think one of the biggest things about him is just, even when he was struggling, people were semi-outraged at the fact that his OPS was only 815. You know, and you look at everything that has happened in this Braves outfield this year with Markakis, he was all right for a minute, and then he kind of struggled, and then he wound up getting hurt. And Austin Riley came up, and he was hotter than the sun, and then he just sucked. And then Ender was awful for a little while, and then he was on the aisle for 2 months. And Adam Duvall came up, and then he was great for a minute, and now he's totally regressing. I mean, Acuña has been like the centerpiece of the team, obviously, but especially of the outfield. Like, he's the only one that's out there that's really been like that you have consistently been able to run out day after day after day and count on the fact that he's going to be productive for you.
Absolutely. And it's because of that, and we're going to get off the Acuña train here because we've been talking about Acuña for 20 minutes and we could probably talk for 20 more. It's just a testament to what he means to this team. He's already on that same plateau as Freddie, as being that guy that the team turns to get them out of slumps and to energize the team. It's just another mark of just how good he is and how good a place baseball is in right now with these young guys, because the Nationals can certainly say the same things about Juan Soto. The Mets can say the same thing about Pete Alonso. There's just so many great young players in the game right now that we're about to enter a golden age of baseball, and I can't wait to see it. And the Braves, by the way, it's not just Ronald Acuña talk. they got what I think might be the most surprising good news of all time. And that's that Austin Riley went to get an MRI from Dr. James Andrews and actually got good news and actually got told he didn't need surgery. That may be the first time ever that somebody's gone to Dr. Andrews and not needed surgery.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as his name comes up, it's like he's the Grim Reaper. You know, it's he never, ever gives good news to anybody. Everybody's always like, oh, I'm going to go get a second opinion. I can't trust the guy who's going to operate on everybody if he gets the chance. And, you know, the timing of the injury, it almost might be kind of convenient for the fact that Riley was deep inside his own head. I mean, you've seen what he can be when he's on fire. But he had gotten into some really bad habits. He was in between pitches, like he was too fast for off-speed, but he was too slow for elite velocity. Like, he just was really struggling. I mean, at a certain point, why wouldn't you just throw him sliders away over and over? But I think, more than anything, getting a chance for him to get completely healthy, this gives him a chance to kind of reset his focus mentally, get out of that a little bit, and then when he comes back, I think he said it'll be a couple weeks. So give him, say, 3 more weeks. Say he comes back in the beginning of September, and hopefully he'll have a refreshed approach. And as long as you can kind of put the Band-Aid on the outfield until then, you know, you've got Acuna, and Inciarte has been great since he came back, and then you put Riley out there too. Nobody's really sure what's going on with Markakis' wrist right now, so having like a good, solid, reliable third outfielder out there is it's crucial. I can't believe he doesn't need surgery, though. I was positive we weren't going to see him again until 2020.
And I'm glad you mentioned that about Riley getting a reset. They asked me at 680 on Wednesday. They asked me about, you know, Riley going there. And I do think that you're right about that. It's now that we know that it's not a huge injury that's not going to take a long time, this could have been perfect timing for him because he wasn't coming out of that slump. He was making everything worse, as a matter of fact. The longer it kept going, the worse he got. So the timing of it, he gets to take a mental break. He gets to really focus on at least focusing on his knee, but it makes him focus on his fundamentals while you're doing that to make sure that everything you're doing is in line. He could come out of this better for the experience. He's been sitting back and watching now and being able to analyze pitchers and see things from the dugout, which sometimes you get better clarity watching than you do when you're in the middle of a game. This could end up being huge for Austin Riley, and it could be huge for the Braves because, like you mentioned, Duvall started to faceplant a little bit. Ender has played really, really well. He's actually got more walks than strikeouts, which is not something I would have ever predicted that I would say. And he's really picked up the slack for Markakis being down. But even so, the Braves have needed not just another starter in the outfield, but their bench has been severely tested with Dansby being out. And the news on Dansby, not quite as good, although you heard something today that I did not see. So sounds like Dansby, we might be starting to get a timetable on him as well.
Yeah, according to Paul Byrd, Dansby has started to hit, which is a brand new development. He hasn't started running yet, like doing sprints and base running drills, but that's like the last step before he gets cleared. And he's going to wind up having to do at least one rehab start. But you saw last year in the playoffs, because Dansby got, 2 weeks left in the season, or last week of the season, something like that, and there was no time to fix anything like that. So Culberson wound up getting, I think, all of the starts at short in the NLDS last year. And like you said, the bench was tested. This is when they still had Ryan Flaherty on the bench. And the 2019 bench is better than that, but it still is like Camargo is not, oh God, it breaks my heart to say that he's just not it right now. And Culberson, he's been such a godsend as a bench player, but even when he starts to log any type of meaningful innings as a starter, then his effectiveness kind of starts to wane. And you're seeing, I know we're going to talk about the bullpen in the second half of the show and how unlucky they have been just with batting average on balls in play, but I think that a lot of that has to do with Dansby as a defender. Even when he was struggling in previous years, he was so great in the field. And even if that has kind of taken a step back this year, you take an even bigger step back when you've got Camargo out there whose focus is just shot. Like, he when he wasn't hitting before, then it's like, you know, maybe that's understandable because there's no playing time, but now he's not even fielding things cleanly anymore. So what do you do?
I mean, I hate to say it, you know how much I love Johan Camargo, but he is absolutely lost right now. And I've, you know, early in the season, I would have said it's the no playing time, but the struggles offensively have followed him into the field, and he's messing up on plays that Johan has never had the most range at shortstop ever since he put on the muscle, but he's always been sure-handed. Like, that's always been his thing, is that if he gets to the ball, he's making the play if he makes a accurate throw. But his hands were always his strong suit. Now he's bobbling balls on transfers. He's bobbling balls all over the place. He's not getting great reads on balls. It's just, it's snowballing on him, and you can see it out there. He's starting to really get frustrated. There was a strikeout last night where Johan is a guy that's usually pretty even-keeled. You don't really tell if he's upset or not at a strikeout. Last night, he's taking the helmet off and slamming it down and looking around like, you got to be kidding me. For Johan, this has been absolutely as bad as it could possibly be. He didn't get the time he was supposed to early in the year. He got moved as a true bench player instead of a super utility like he was led to believe. But now that he's actually had the chance, the opportunity to establish himself and earn more playing time, he's face planted. And there's going to be a lot of people saying, oh, see, I knew this was going to happen with Johan. If you seriously looked at his numbers last year and thought that this was going to happen this year, this has just been a disaster of a season for him. And I still do think Johan is a very valuable player, but at this point in the year, you can't wait for him to turn it around. Maybe you go out and get an Adeni Echevarria, who the Mets put on release waivers yesterday, because Adeni can't hit at all, period, but at least he can play shortstop.
Truthfully, the offensive numbers that Echevarria has put up this year are not wholly dissimilar to what Camargo has done.
Right, and that's a mark to just how bad Camargo's been offensively, because Adeni Echevarria might be one of the worst hitting shortstops in baseball.
True, and you look at the playoffs, and one of the oldest cliches is a base runner is a rally, you know, in the playoffs. And when you're dealing with somebody who, if a pitcher walks somebody, then that's bad. If somebody reaches on an error, that's even worse, because the entire team, you can just feel everything shift. And you see that look on Camargo's face when he does something wrong. Last night, Braves wound up winning this game against the Mets, but the bases were loaded with one out in the ninth because he bobbled ball in the transfer. And while the replay was in deliberation, they showed him, and he looked scared. I think that it's I talked about self-fulfilling prophecies earlier. I think that he's so deep in his own head about, don't screw this up, don't screw this up. So the first thing he does is he immediately screws it up, because he's not thinking about doing things the right way. He's thinking about not doing them the wrong way. And, you know, he knows that the fan base has turned on him. He knows that you know, there were people that were outraged on his behalf for a very long time. And now it's just like, yeah, well, whatever, this guy sucks. And that's hard to deal with. You know, that's really, really hard to deal with. So he needs regular playing time. We saw how effective he can be when he gets that. Even if it's just down at Gwinnett, there's, what, 2-3 weeks left in the season. He could be a really valuable piece for that Gwinnett team, because it looks like they're going to wind up winning their division down there and going to the playoffs. Get him some time to play every day. I can't imagine the Braves are going to call up Pedro Florimon. And This is an area where I know Travis DeMeritt had spent a lot of time as an outfielder, but he was a middle infielder by trade. If he hadn't been called up to fill one of the outfield roles, I think that you would see him getting a lot of reps at second, because he was a plus defender at second base. So, that trade, it hurts. It hurts for a number of reasons, and that's just another one. So, I don't know. Maybe you see Echevarria. You know, maybe Anthopoulos calls up Paul Janisch.
What's Daniel Castro doing?
What's that?
So what's Daniel Castro doing these days?
Oh, geez. You know, he's I'm sure he's out there and available if Anthopoulos really needs to reach out to him. So I don't know. I mean, he's just not doing it at all. And so I hope, for Johan's sake more than anything else, like, I don't even care about it through the actual winning, losing lens. You just hate to see this happen to somebody that we leaned on so much last year.
And you really do, a guy that had such a great story behind his name, and it looked like he was really taking that big step. Hopefully he can overcome this and the Braves can overcome it. I would expect a move to be made shortly, at least once we know definitively how long it'll be before Dansby comes out. Then maybe you can see them kind of grab somebody who can at least play some defense. We were supposed to talk about Max Fried in this segment, which you guys know means I'm a very happy guy. I'm going to push this to the next segment, though, so we're going to come back with some good news when we start talking Max Fried. Hanging through the break, we'll be right back here on the Platinum Sombrero.
This week's episode of the Platinum Sombrero podcast is brought to you by the Happy Beginnings Massage Parlor. Let's face it, life is hard, and sometimes you just don't have any time to waste. So here at Happy Beginnings, you can come right in and get down to business. We'll get you in and out lickety-split. If life's got you by the balls, we can too. We can help you release your stress and then some. And if you're feeling overextended, our service can't be beat. Afraid to ask? Don't be. Don't beat around the bush. That's our job. Stop in today for a good old-fashioned rub down. If you need it, we'll need it. We've even been bestowed with the highest possible honor, the Robert Kraft Seal of Approval. Happy beginnings, because who's got time to wait for a happy ending? Patent pending.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Platinum Sombrero, brought to you by SeatGeek. For any and all of your ticket buying purchases, whether you're trying to go to a baseball game, to a concert, to a play, or whatever else you might need tickets for, I don't know, I'm not a wizard here, SeatGeek.com is the best place to go. They've got an outstanding algorithm that they use across the internet to manage and see what other ticket buyers are charging for certain seats, what other people are charging for certain seats, and they'll let you know what is a good deal, what is a bad deal, and what is just an okay deal, so you can have the most confidence possible when buying your seats. SeatGeek.com is also for selling tickets. If you have two tickets to go to a sold-out show, you decide you can't go, just put them up on SeatGeek. SeatGeek will tell you how much you should be charging based on what show you're going to, what seats you're in, and how in demand it is. SeatGeek really takes the guesswork out of things like this, makes it a whole lot easier to buy and sell your tickets. Use our promo code ACAA, and you're going to get $20 off at checkout whenever you buy your tickets. That's essentially your seat fee. That's essentially two beers at a ball game. SeatGeek.com makes everything easy for the ultimate fan to have the ultimate fan experience. SeatGeek.com, life's an event, and we have the tickets. All right, so before we get too into this, we got to take our weekly break here to let you guys know how much we appreciate all of the patrons of the show. We love you guys so much. We really appreciate that you guys have felt the need to actually donate to us. Brayden, as our newest patron, that brings us up to a grand total of five now between Tara, Megan, Brayden, Jason Nunnally, and
Aaron Cohen.
Who am I forgetting? Aaron Cohen. Sorry, Aaron. List of top five guys, right? The top five people right there. Thank you guys so much. And for any of you other listeners, if you ever want to give us a buck or two here or there and put your name, get yourself eligible to come and join us for a show, you can go to our Patreon account, which Doc always has on call, which for whatever reason I can never remember. But Doc, why don't you pick up the slack for me and let everybody know where they can go?
Yeah, you can find it at www.patreon.com/TPS_podcast. And as I always like to remind people, type the underscore, do not spell the underscore. There's a huge difference there. So, yeah, really huge thanks to everybody. Every little bit counts. And, you technically own a part of Platinum Sombrero, so you are majority owners. We're like the Green Bay Packers over here, so we're community-owned.
And by the way, we will be debuting a new look here relatively quickly, probably within the next couple days, actually. We'll have a new logo coming out there, as in September, our merchandise will officially be up and ready to purchase. Cannot wait for that. We'll have some new shirts out there for everybody. So we'll find some ways to work some cool stuff in for the rest of you guys. Just, again, thank you guys so much. We got the best listeners in the business. Really do appreciate all the time you guys spend listening to the show and interacting with us. We really do enjoy it. Now, enough of the sappy stuff. Before the break, I said we were going to talk about Max Fried because, duh, this is the Platinum Sombrero, and I run the Platinum Sombrero, and I'm a huge Max Fried fan, and Doc is a huge Max Fried fan, and Doc is kind of my handler, I guess I could say. He might be my ghostwriter at a time or two. I'm not going to confirm nor deny that, but what we're seeing out of Max Fried, and particularly what we saw the other day, that is a huge boon for the Braves. Max went through those huge struggles for, what, about a month, maybe a month and a half, and really looked like he'd hit a wall. And last night, went out, or a couple nights ago, I'm sorry, two nights ago, went out there and had a really, really strong start. Even if the strikeouts weren't there, even if he did walk three, Max ended up minimizing all the damage, giving up one run on the day. And when Max is going like that, that's the Max Fried that the Braves were hoping they would get when they made that trade.
Yeah, and it looks like he's even trying as hard as he can to grow a little bit of a mustache. So he's getting his man growth there. Yeah, there were always questions about the consistency with him. Is he going to throw enough strikes? Is he going to be able to really take that next step? And we're really seeing it this year, but especially since the All-Star break. The last five starts, he's 5-0, 2.93 ERA with a 3.15 FIP, almost 9.5 strikeouts per nine innings, and under three walks per nine innings. And even a lot of the runs that he's giving up, I mean, we've seen this year, all year long. He just gets comical amounts of run support from this Braves offense. And in the start against the Phillies, he was coasting for five innings, and then in the sixth, when the Braves were up, I think, 12-1, 13-1, somewhere around there, he gave up a couple home runs in garbage time. In the start against the Twins, where he struck out 10, two of those runs came across when he wasn't even pitching anymore. Luke Jackson allowed those to cross. So while the Braves are in it, I mean, he is absolutely doing his job. I mean, these runs are still coming across. You never want to see that happen. But while he's in there, he's doing everything he can to keep the team in the game. And he's starting to do some things. Like, I guess I didn't fully realize the fact that he's 14 wins now. I mean, that's among the best in baseball at this point.
14 wins, by the way, and if you care about pitcher wins, I usually don't really care about pitcher wins a ton, unless it fits my narrative, which it does here. Max Fried is actually the MLB leader in wins for a left-handed starter. He has the potential, at least, to be the first Brave since Russ Ortiz to win 20 games. And that's not a nothing number. In today's day and age, you just don't see people get 20 wins anymore. And not that wins really mean a whole lot. Like, we see what happens with Jacob deGrom. Jacob deGrom has 7 wins this season. I don't think anybody, even me, would be so foolish as to tell you that Max Fried is a better pitcher than Jacob deGrom. And there is something to be said by the fact that Fried gets almost 8 runs per 9 innings of run support. It's you know, you could say whether, oh, well, he might not be as good as Soroka. And most of the time that's true. Soroka is the better pitcher of the two. But it doesn't really matter as long as the Braves are winning games. And for Max Fried, all that stuff is outside of his control. All he can control is what he can do. And there's still some real measures of improvement for him to go through. But I thought in this latest outing that we saw a huge, huge step for Max Fried. And that was Rick Kranitz going to bat for Max in the sixth inning, where he ran into some trouble. And you guys have all known, we start seeing the guys on Facebook talking about Max as a five inning and done guy, which kind of gets annoying, even though it's kind of true for the most part, because he's right around 80 to 85 pitches when he starts to really start getting tired. And the Braves haven't really forced him to kind of dig real deep this season because they've been watching his innings and all that stuff. But in this outing, Max gets into the sixth inning. He's got one out to go. Things are starting to get a little hairy, and it looks like Snit is going to bring in Luke Jackson to finish it off. And you can see Kranitz in the dugout kind of getting animated with Snicker, imploring him to let Max finish it out. And Max does. I believe that was the play where Acuna hosed Frazier at the plate. I can't remember if that was the fourth inning or if that was the sixth inning. But Max finishes that sixth inning, finishes right at 100 pitches. And for me, whenever you see a young guy like that who's able to dig deep and overcome some adversity when he's tired and losing his polish, that to me is some of the most important starts for a guy. Now, there's been better starts than what he had last night. I said the 3 walks to only 4 strikeouts. I think he had 4 or 5 hits against him. But being able to dig deep and preserve the lead with the runners on base and get it back to your offense, that to me was absolutely huge for Fried.
And that's such a huge confidence booster too, knowing that your pitching coach has your back. And managers anymore are really, really quick with the hook. Say like, all right, this guy's getting in the soup. We want to limit his pitches. You know, we're not going to let him. Yeah. The fact that Trevor Bauer goes out and he throws like 115, 120 pitches, like, just about every start. I mean, that's very rare. 100 is about the top of the scale. And like you said, Fried usually kind of is running on fumes by the time he gets to that point. and as evidenced by what we were just talking about with giving up the home runs and garbage time to the Phillies and what happened with the Twins. So yeah, that's huge for him, knowing that everybody in the dugout's got his back and Snit trusts him enough to say, all right, let's see it. What can you do? And even if he did have to get bailed out by Acuña throwing 99 from the outfield, he got out of it. You know, sometimes you're gonna have your defense is just gonna pick you up like that. So you're never gonna learn how to get through this stuff without having to look it in the face and actually get through it. So and there's no guarantee that he's gonna be able to keep up what he's done over the last five starts, but he just keeps doing it. And ever since the start where he left with the blister, there haven't appeared to have been any ill effects from that, knock on wood there. But yeah, this is huge. And at a certain point, you know, wins are flawed. All stats are flawed, really. But wins in particular, they've definitely got some warts on it there. But getting to 14 with 6 weeks left in the season, I mean, even talking about getting to 20, most of the time that just isn't a thing anymore. Run support, whatever. I mean, you still got to go out and you got to pitch the way that he's pitching to get to 20. So that's not insignificant. And when he's getting to the point where he's getting into arbitration and he's going to start commanding more money, I mean, these are the types of stats that will get you more money. So good for him. If he's looking to get paid one of these days, then that's which he deserves to, then these are the types of things that will help him there.
I mean, good for him and good for the Braves, because when you talk about the Braves, when you've got the two young guys like Soroka and Fried that you can count on, that's a fantastic foundation, especially with the steps that Max Fried has taken lately. Soroka, I feel like, barely had to take any steps when he came up. Soroka was already about as poised as a 35-year-old coming up. For Soroka, it's really just been about seeing what major league hitters do and adjusting off of that. I mean, the way I kind of describe them is Soroka is a surgeon. Everything he does is so precise. Where he places it, how he attacks certain hitters at certain points in the game. It's very Maddox-like, very Adam Wainwright-like. Just very, very ahead of the game and always thinking ahead. Max Fried is not a surgeon in that instance. Max Fried is more like an artist, where Soroka's pitches are very effective. None of them are really super overpowering pitches. Like, he doesn't have an Aroldis Chapman slider. He doesn't have a Noah Syndergaard fastball. He doesn't have a Jordan Hicks sinker or what have you, or Blake Treinen sinker. But every pitch he has, he's able to command. Whereas Max Fried has all of these. He's got the 98 mile an hour fastball he can lean back on. He's got the sharp breaking, big breaking hook. His slider has come so far to be one of those beautiful late breaking sliders. His cutter is starting to pick up a lot of movement. Everything Max throws just looks. They look like better. They look like, I don't want to say better pitches, but they look like more dangerous pitches to hitters. Everything Max does has this grace to it. And when Max is rolling really well, there's not many pitchers in baseball who are going to go out and have better starts than him, at least until he gets tired. Soroka, I think, is a lot more consistent, because you'll see good Max and you'll see bad Max, where he starts to lose location and starts to lose his arm slot. But the way you've got these two guys going, and if Max can continue those steps in his development, you're talking about already having the numbers 1 and 2 filled out in your rotation, and you feel great about it.
And he got the chance to pitch in the playoffs a little bit last year, too. So, you know, last year everybody looked like they were kind of blinded by the bright lights going into the playoffs, playing the Dodgers. And I think that for everybody, they kind of, I don't want to say they shut down, but I think that everybody was really overwhelmed last year. So now, aside from Acuña with the grand slam off Walker Buehler, but you'll start to see when the Braves wind up making it to the playoffs, you know, once again, hopefully. So, you know, the magic number is like 36, but I'm not getting totally ahead of myself here. But yeah, I mean, I think you're really going to start to see the fact that they don't have to go through quite as many mental hurdles as they went through last year. And Fried was a reliever in the playoffs last year. And this is not to say that he would necessarily wind up getting a start in the playoffs. I certainly hope so, but I think that he's going to be much better equipped to be a weapon in the playoffs than he would have been last year. So this is all great stuff right here. And for as many big games that are coming up too, because there's a ton of games against the Nats and the Phillies and a bunch of division rivals coming up here soon. So getting those big marquee games even if it's just a couple under his belt to kind of keep the momentum going as we roll into the playoffs once again, hopefully, is just huge. It's absolutely huge. So, and all of that packages together to give you like 2020, 2021 Max Fried. When we were talking about Acuña, we drilled so deep into the point that he's still so young. And this Fried, this is his first season as a full-time starter on this team. So, and he's only 25. So just another wonderful, wonderful building block.
He's 25 and he kind of missed 2 years of development. And I haven't really had the chance to talk about this as much. I've talked about it in the Locked On a little bit, but I want to bounce it off you. For Max, I think the next step in his development really is going to be the confidence to shake off his catchers or tell his catchers what he wants instead of letting the catchers dictate everything he does. Because I don't know if I just noticed this because I tune in a little bit more closely for Fried starts. I'll have to pay some extra special attention to some Soroka starts. But with Max, I noticed that the catchers, both of them in spurts, get very, very predictable. And they'll lock Max into throwing not just the same pitches like Tyler Flower does, but the same patterns. And for instance, there was an at-bat with Jeff McNeil in the fourth inning, I believe, where McCann had Max throw every single pitch for like 5-6 pitches in a row on the outside corner, enough to the point where Frenchie and Glavin were both remarking on it while calling the game. And that's something that Max has to learn as a pitcher to tell a guy, hey, stop calling it in the same location, because major league hitters are really, really good at their job. Think of the worst major league hitter. He's still great at his job. And you can't let a guy know what location you're going to be at. Then he's going to be able to dive over the plate. He has to be able to respect the inside corner. And for Max, I think that's probably the next stage in his development, because he really doesn't shake off catchers. Whatever they put down, wherever they put it down, he throws it, and he trusts his guys. And that's good to a point. But I think for these guys to go from being good arms and good potential to being elite type of pitchers, I think they have to have this sort of confidence about themselves that I know exactly what I want to do. You're my catcher. You're going to catch it where I want to throw it.
There's something to that. I think a lot of it has to do with having confidence in your own game plan, which isn't necessarily to say Max doesn't know what he's doing or know where he wants to throw something, but he's still pretty wet behind the ears. Like I said, this is the first time that he's been a full-time starter in the big leagues, and Brian McCann has been around the block. You know, there might be something in Max's head where he's saying, okay, well, maybe he knows something that I don't. Maybe I forgot something from the game plan. And people love to hate on Tyler Flowers. And I can't say that I'm totally it's not that I don't get it, but I mean, he's much better than people give him credit for, even if he does get a lot more predictable with his game calling. But you know, maybe it's something where he's just trying to get more comfortable with the role and figure out exactly how to proceed himself. So I think that you'll start to see that more and more as he goes, if he's not dealing with guys that are such seasoned veterans. Because, I mean, both of those guys have been around for 10 years apiece, at least.
I would agree. It's just one of I don't see it with Soroka. With Soroka, it's inside, it's outside, it's low, it's high. He works all four quadrants of the plate. And I just tend to notice it when it's with Max that he'll end up getting a lot of pitches called consecutively in the same location. Even if they're different pitches, that's still a pattern that major league hitters can recognize. And it makes it harder on yourself. And for Max, a lot of the problems with him as far as getting into the sixth inning is the pitch counts, where he'll be up 82, 85 pitches through five innings. And like you said, it's his first year as a full-time starter. You got to kind of build that gas tank up. Like, you're not just born with the ability to go out and throw 300 pitches in an outing. You got to kind of work towards that. And that's usually the last thing that young guys really learn how to do, is how to go deeper into games. So one of the things he could really do is keep hitters off balance enough to where he can start putting guys away when it's 0-2 and cut down on some of these superfluous pitches.
And you are starting to see that a little bit more in the past couple of games. Now, I don't know if that's working, doing more groundwork before the game, working with Kranitz, what exactly is coming. But like that start against the Twins, I didn't get a chance to see this most recent game against the Mets. I was in Gwinnett, but man, he's just, he really does seem like he's dialing it up, and he's getting a lot better idea of what he wants to do. He's touching 98. He's dancing all around the zone where he wants to. So maybe it's just being more comfortable working with these guys. I don't know. I think that he's locking in. To me, he's locking in.
I think he absolutely is. I think he's figured something out as opposed to where he was at before. I think that it's good for the Braves, and I think it's a good sign for Max, because I think he definitely wants to be in that playoff series and get a chance to redeem himself against the Dodgers. Speaking of whom, Max will have his chance to take on the Dodgers again this weekend in what I think is probably the most important series of the year for the Braves as far as really figuring out where exactly you are and how you stack up.
No question. No question about it. That Twins series had a very distinct playoff feel, but that's, I think, just because it's two really good teams that were playing each other. Now, you know, if the Braves wind up playing the Twins in the playoffs, then it's the World Series. For this, there is a lot of history between the Braves and the Dodgers. You're looking at, I mean, these are 1 and 2 in the National League, and these are teams that are not going to wind up playing each other in the first round of the playoffs if the season ended today. So you're looking at a potential NLCS matchup. There's some real big brother, little brother stuff going on between these two teams. A lot of demons there. The last two times the Braves have been in the playoffs, they've been knocked out by the Dodgers. And back earlier this season, Braves were in disarray. You know, they were 20 and 21 when they saw the Dodgers last time. Acuna was still batting cleanup. This was the series, you know, they got swept in LA, and that was when they said, okay, we got to change something up here. And that was the catalyst for moving Acuna up at the top of the lineup and putting Donaldson fourth, which has been huge, absolutely huge. Changed the entire trajectory of the season doing that. So you almost have to look at that series as being like a completely different team. Braves have played really well against teams that are over 500 this year. Unfortunately, so have the Dodgers. Braves are 39 and 32 against teams above 500, and I think the Dodgers are like 39 and 18, something like that. I mean, they're so very good. And Fried, that was his worst start of the year when he faced the Dodgers. He got knocked out. He got hit in the head.
Hit in the wrist, I believe it was.
Oh, that's right. That's
forearm,
right.
Forearm.
So, yeah, he wound up getting pulled early from that game. So I think that Fried has a chance to kind of exercise some demons. The Braves in general have the chance to exercise some demons. If they can take two, like, I don't even care if they – I obviously would love to see them sweep. But, I mean, winning one would be doing better than they did last time. And if they can just take two, then that's a humongous confidence builder. Because the Dodgers, it cannot be overstated – how good the Dodgers are in every facet of the, like, everywhere you look, the Dodgers are just, they're like 40 games over 500. You know, they're tracking to win 108 or something. They just, they're brutal. So now the Braves got to come out, they got to be on their A game. Everybody's got to just show up. And, you know, if you were around SunTrust this weekend, go out, support the team, because they're going to need you.
And if you're interested in the matchups, the Braves are going to get a very interesting set of matchups. They are going to dodge Walker Buehler and Clayton Kershaw if everything holds steady the way it's projected to right now. Friday would be Kenta Maeda for the Dodgers and Mike Soroka for the Braves. That's how you want to start a series, is with your best pitcher on the mound. Saturday would be Hyun-Jin Ryu versus Folty, who has pitched a lot better, but not necessarily against teams like the Dodgers. And then Sunday would be Dustin May, the ginger guard flamethrower, against the aforementioned Max Fried. That will be, not only is it huge as a litmus test for the Braves, I think it's huge for the future of the Braves as far as seeing these young guys go out there and facing off against a team like the Dodgers, where if you're ever going to take 2 out of 3 from them, this is the series where you're going to do it.
And not just for this year. We were talking about this on the break. I mean, it's unfair to have the level of money that the Dodgers have and also have an elite-level farm system. Like, they're not going to stop coming. I mean, just you know, if the Braves beat them this year, you know, by the grace of God or whatever you want to call him or her, then, you know, there's not saying that the Dodgers are just going to be like a mediocre team next year. I mean, this is shaping up to be like a really, really long rivalry. So they're going to have to figure out how to best Cody Bellinger and Max Muncy and Jock Peterson. And yeah, they're lucky that they don't face Kershaw and Buehler now, but they'll face him in the playoffs. Like they gotta bring it, man. Like you said, it's a litmus test, not just for them in the general NL race, but also just to see, like, this is one versus two. You don't get to be one without beating one. So I'm scared, but I'm really hopeful. You know, they're kind of on a roll right now. It doesn't seem like it, just because, you know, the bullpen is doing that thing, but the last series they lost was against the Royals, and that was almost a month ago. They're 4-0-2 in their last six series. They're actually playing pretty decent baseball as long as the bullpen doesn't really get in the way, which is going to be a really, really important point moving forward, because in the same way that the Braves take advantage of bad bullpens because they're a really good offensive team, so do the Dodgers. So there's like zero room for error here.
None at all. This is one of those series where you're ready to go before it even starts. So it gets kind of important to make sure that you remember that it's still just one series. And while it is an important litmus test, it doesn't make or break the postseason, especially as it's going today. The Braves will be facing off with the Cubs in the first round, which certainly not an easy team to get by, even though I would pick the Braves. But I do want to see the Braves finally front up the bully on the block and punch the big brother in the nose a little bit and kind of get some of their own back. So I'm excited to see the series. I'm just really excited to see Dustin May in general. I haven't got to see much of him yet, so I'll be excited to watch him. And to see him go off against Max Fried will be even better for me. But if the Braves are going to be serious contenders this year, and they certainly have a chance to, they've got to figure this bullpen out. And it's not necessarily for the reasons everybody's thinking. We know that the three that they've acquired have not looked great since they've come over, but it's been a lot more than just those three have been bad. It's really been, if it weren't happening to my team, I would swear it was the Mets.
You look at the surface numbers, and, you know, we did our advanced analytics episode, and we dug into why some of these numbers are important and everything, but, you know, people tend to look at ERA, whether it's, you know, we talked about wins being flawed, ERA is very flawed too. Especially when you look at, you know, Mark Melanson's ERA since coming to the Braves is 10.13. Shane Green's was over 11 the last time I saw, and I think Chris Martin's is as well. Melanson's FIP is under 1. Green's is like 7. He hasn't really been that great. But you start looking at what's going into this. You look at batting average on balls in play for Mark Melanson since he came here, it's over 500. So Shane Green's is even worse. It's closer to 600. It was like 647 yesterday before he finally worked his first clean inning. And Chris Martin's is 467. League average is 300. The strand rates are like, they're just everywhere you look. It's like Luke Jackson's luck has completely permeated everything that is happening to this team. It's just dribblers and worm burners that are just barely getting by, or you have Johan Camargo who is losing the ball on a transfer, and like, self-fulfilling prophecy. That's going to be the title of this episode, because like that's what it comes back to. Like, don't let this ball get by, and there it goes. You know, the Braves got four hits in a row. Last night we were talking about the BABIP gods, and they were smiling on us all of a sudden. But then in the ninth, they did the same thing to the Mets because they got four hits in a row and just barely out of reach, or just some stupid little occurrence that's happening. So if the bullpen, namely these three guys, because they went out and got them for a reason, if these three guys turn it around like on a dime, I'm going to be not surprised whatsoever. Just because you start digging into some of these numbers, it's like, this is completely improbable. Chris Martin's left on base rate is 39.5. It was like 75-80% when he was in Texas. Same thing with Melanson and Green. We knew there was some regression coming from Green, but insane. This is, it's nuts.
And I would certainly agree that Melanson and Martin are due for big turnarounds here shortly, especially Melanson. When you talk about a guy whose FIP and ERA difference is literally like 9 runs, I think that Melanson has pitched very well, and you could tell he was not happy about getting pulled out of that game yesterday.
Yeah, he was mad.
Yeah, when you could read his lips, and he's just, wow, okay, wow. He was very not happy, but if that's the way the luck is going, sometimes it's a tough luck pull. Like you can't really do much more than that. For Martin, he's getting hit a little bit harder than I was expecting him to. He's given up a few more hits than I thought. He's walked one batter as a Brave, which is, you know, that's kind of what the story is. He doesn't walk a lot of people, although I believe he walked somebody in like his second outing for the Braves. It's how I knew our bullpen was cursed. But those two, I think, are going to be fine. There's still some – whether or not you want to admit it, there is a real chance that Shane Green is not good for the Braves. Shane Green has been, if you look at his career numbers, he has been a horrific reliever more often than he has been a good one. That's just the way he plays. And while certainly there's some bad luck going on right now for him, especially when you talk about the BABIP, not all of that bad luck can be attributed to luck. A lot of it can be contributed to the fact that he's leaving cutters at 92 miles an hour, middle, and you're not going to fool a lot of people when you do that.
True, and I am not blind to the fact that there has been a little bit of spike in hard hit contact rates. And you were talking about, you know, we will use these stats when they fit our narrative, and that's definitely what I'm doing here. But the sample sizes are kind of small enough to where you can still say, you know, it's been 5 innings for Melanson and round about the same for the other two guys. I mean, would you like to see them come over and just immediately dominate? Well, of course, you know, but we didn't get Felipe Vasquez. You know, we didn't wind up getting Aroldis Chapman. We got these guys who their batted ball profiles and the way they tend to pitch was supposed to wind up being a solid match here. When at the trade deadline, when we got these guys, you know, the expectation was that Dansby was only going to be out for a second, and he was supposed to be back by now. And some of these, I hate to use the term, but kind of boneheaded plays that Camargo has made, and I'm not trying to pile on him here because God knows that he's got it bad enough without my help.
But I mean, it's not just been Camargo; it's been whoever's been a shortstop, because Charlie, for whatever reason, when it gets to the ninth inning, Charlie can't catch a cold.
Yeah, it's strange, the whole thing. And Dansby is very missed out there. He's even if he's not spectacular, he makes the plays that he's supposed to make. So, and that's something that we haven't really seen a lot recently. So I'm going to give it a little more time. Like I said, I'm not going to be surprised if these guys come out and turn it around tomorrow. I mean, you're not going to sustain a 178 BABIP like Green did while he was in Detroit, but he's also not going to sustain a 579 like he's got now. So the truth is somewhere in the middle there. So
right. So if I were to say, I still believe this to be true. I think Shane Green and Luke Jackson are a wash. I think they're pretty similar. I think that Shane Green will eventually end up in that Luke Jackson mold. I think Chris Martin is better than the two of them because I think he's the one guy in the bullpen you can count on not to walk people, and he's got higher impact stuff. And I think Melanson is the one that's going to separate as being the closer for the team, and I still expect that to happen. I mean, once Dansby gets back, then things can kind of start to settle down a little bit as far as a lot of these ground balls, a lot of these fluky little hits will stop. You're not going to have a team get little bloop singles off you with like 56 mile an hour EVs every game. That eventually is going to stop. But a lot of these guys, they have to get more comfortable with the catchers too. You can't just say they'll come over and dominate right away because it's different styles of game calling. It's different styles of setups for the catchers. It could be different styles of the target they present. And these pitchers haven't been working with these catchers. So it does take a little bit of time. So in that instance, maybe that could be what's hurting Shane Green more than anything else. Is just not – Shane Green doesn't really have the stuff to get away with mistakes over the heart of the plate. So he's got to kind of get used to his catcher and maybe settle down that way until they get more in sync. That could very well be it. The one thing that's for certain, the Braves are undefeated since Sean Newcomb destroyed a fire extinguisher.
It takes different strokes to move the world. And I think, honestly, as crazy as this sounds – you know, that game was just, you just couldn't believe it. You know, you can't 6-2 going into the bottom of the ninth inning, and you've got your shutdown reliever coming on, and then it just keeps coming and coming and coming. Like, it was the exact same thing that what happened with the Mets. Like, every single ball that was in play found a hole somehow. And then Newcomb, who is pretty stoic for the most part. I mean, you can never really tell what's happening with him. And to have somebody like that go out and just completely... Well, apparently, there were conflicting reports about whether or not he hit it with a bat or he kicked a trash can, and then it wound up spraying everything, and then the team had to vacate the clubhouse, and everybody's just sitting out there just covered in the dust and everything. I mean, it's one of those things that's almost so ridiculous that it forces you to just say, okay, this is out of control, and maybe kind of force a mindset change. So... that's what I'm hoping anyway, but you're right. At the time of recording, Braves are 3-0 since Newcomb kind of lost his mind.
I hope he took a bat to it. That's just so much better than kicking a trash can and that causing everything. That's more an accident. I hope he took a bat and just obliterated that fire extinguisher. That could be the spark that's needed. But in all seriousness, the bullpen will turn around at some point, and we will be here to bring you those when it does. But for now, we've got to cut short our recording for today. Thanks for joining me. And to everybody out there, let's go get this sweep tonight and go into this Dodgers series and show them that we ain't no punks.
Very well said. Thank you very much for having me on again, Dylan. This is episode 76 for TPS and 75 for me. So you got to celebrate the milestone last week, and now it's my turn. So it feels good. Really does feel good. Thank you, everybody, who made it to the end of this episode.
Thank you, guys. Y'all have a great night. We'll be back next week right here on the Platinum Sombrero.
Okay, thanks. Bye.